If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
And whether your gig is mobile home parks or single family fix and flips or apartments or self-storage or whatever, the 2.0 is when you get to the point that you're really no longer managing the real estate. You're managing people that manage the real estate, both on site as well as off site, like marketing and accounting and some legal. So it's critically important to make yourself irrelevant.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Jefferson is a self-made millionaire real estate investor in mobile home parks. He has purchased nearly $100 million worth of mobile home parks, generated double-digit returns for his 200-plus investors, and expanded the supply of affordable housing. Jefferson's business both makes a lot of money and does social good for lower-income Americans. He is media savvy and started the mobile home park industry's first podcast, MobileHomeParkInvestors.com, and has raised several tens of millions of dollars through his shows. Jefferson, welcome to the show.
Sam, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure's all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on. Where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
So I had sort of a 20-year career prior to getting into real estate. Where I was right before was I was working out in Silicon Valley for the third of three high-tech startups that I had been at. I'd kind of ridden the dot-com boom and bust. And basically, I was looking for some passive income, some stable income to kind of smooth out those stock options that I had. Anyway, I started looking for an apartment building. I figured I'd, you know, stay within my quote unquote circle of competence, as Warren Buffett advises. I'm not in his league, but I try to be. So I figured, you know, I'd always lived in a house or an apartment building. Why don't I buy an apartment building? That must be my circle of competence. And then just in looking around and searching and finding multifamily properties, you know, there'd be 99 apartment buildings at, you know, an 8 cap. And this is back in like 2005 pricing. And then there'd be one mobile home park at, you know, a 10 cap. And I thought, oh, that's absurd. I'm not buying a friggin' trailer park. I'd delete the search and search somewhere else. Lubbock, Texas, Peoria, Illinois, Ames, Iowa, on and on. I kept getting hit over the head with their higher cap rates. And finally, after 5 or 10 of those, I thought, well, all right, maybe I'll look into this. And, you know, it seems to be multifamily. Let me look into it and see what it's all about. And then I pretty quickly discovered that it's just a great little niche. It is very hard to find them because it's a niche. It is so small. But if you can find them, you can do, I think, better in mobile home parks really than most any other niche.
That is fascinating. So what was the first park you purchased?
So the first park I purchased is called Noble Estates, and it's out in Slaughterville, Oklahoma. What do you think the price of real estate is in a town called Slaughterville?
You know, I'm going to guess that it's pretty cheap.
Low. Yeah. It is actually a surprisingly well-to-do, really suburb of Norman, Oklahoma. Norman is where OU is. Okay. So you've got a lot of higher income professors and other university jobs. Norman is quite a good place to be. I'm not in Norman. I'm about 10 miles from it. So I found this park just by scratching and looking around. I actually found it on eBay, of all places. So I didn't literally click and PayPal the guy $500,000, but it was sort of like a classified ad. And I picked up the phone and called and got it under contract and then got on a plane and got out there and did my diligence. But that's where I found it. I own it to this day. I bought it right. We've had some issues with some of the infrastructure. So it's been, shall we say, quite a learning experience. But I own it to this day. It's doing well. It's appraised at nearly 3 times what I paid for it. So that's how I got my start. I was managing it entirely myself.
Oh, wow.
I now own, right now, I believe, 22 mobile home parks. So I've grown. I've hired people. I no longer am picking up the phone. And, you know, Sam, I started off doing actually my own bookkeeping on QuickBooks for the first 4 months. That was I guess, a good learning experience, but again, not something I do now.
Right.
But so I just started managing it in my part time. It was a small park. I still had my day job for about a year. So it was a relatively easy transition then after a year into a property that I had gotten to know and could see some even more significant upside from if I would manage it and put some money and time into it. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Now that's fascinating. You bought a mobile home park. You said in Norman or Slaughterville.
South of Norman, Slaughterville.
Yeah, there's a name that I still can't get over that. But in Slaughterville, Oklahoma, and you're based out of San Francisco.
Yes, where real estate is somewhat more expensive than in Slaughterville.
Than anywhere in Oklahoma. Yep. Yeah. Now that's interesting. And then you self-managed it. So you're putting it were there park-owned homes?
That's a good question. There were not. That was a pretty clean purchase. I believe there were four homes that the seller owned, and he agreed to take them back and just pay me the rent. So technically, I bought it without park-owned homes. Perhaps not surprisingly, he backpedaled out of those homes pretty quickly, including selling one of the homes without telling me, to a guy who I believe was both a sex offender and a bank robber. Oh, wow. So we had to get rid of that tenant. So, yeah. You know, you got to be careful. I probably would have done better to just buy the four park-owned homes and have more control over whom they got sold to. But again, a lesson learned.
Right, yeah, because if he's on the hook to sell and he knows that he has to get those owner financed or whatever it is that he's doing,
yeah.
You're going to put anybody in there that'll sign the lease.
That's it.
Yikes.
Yeah, he did. So anyway, so I've made pretty much every mistake in the book, or at least every time I say that, I then discover the next day I make some new mistake, but I'll say it again. I've made every mistake in the book.
What are some of those?
So I don't do that in anymore. We're much more careful about really staying on top of the homes and making sure we handle them ourselves and get them into the hands of responsible citizens and not really dark criminals.
Right. Yeah, I can only imagine. Now, $100 million worth of mobile home parks, in my mind, is a lot more than, say, $100 million in multifamily. I feel like in multifamily, you can spend $100 million really quickly. But
yes.
100 million in mobile home parks, I feel like used to at least go a lot further. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Because we're not generally not buying the homes, the quote unquote bricks and mortar. Most of our parks would be somewhere between 80 and 100% resident owned homes. Mm-hmm. So we're just buying the land. And so our per pad acquisition price, and of course it depends on the market, but generally is anywhere between 20 and maybe 40,000 per pad. And that would be in markets where apartments would probably trade at basically twice that, probably $40,000 to $80,000 per door for an apartment. But again, we generally are not buying the quote unquote bricks and mortar, those actual mobile homes. So yeah, we got to buy basically twice. We got to have twice as many tenants to actually invest $100 million versus if we were in apartments. But the nice thing is, while tenants are complexity and that gives us a lot more to manage, the nice thing is that in this business, again, most of those tenants own their homes. That means they own those proverbial leaky toilets and leaky roofs. So our repair and maintenance headache is a lot lower than what it would be if those were apartments. So
what are some of the things that are, I mean, so basically you're left with infrastructure. I mean, because you've got essentially lot rent.
Yeah, the pipes, the roads, yep, that sort of stuff. Occasionally a lift station for the sewer system. We've got a couple of properties on well. Most are all city utilities, but yeah, so we're just really responsible for maintaining the land, getting grass cut for our parks up in the north. We've got one as far north as Fairbanks, Alaska. Oh, wow. Believe me, there's snow plowing and really like scraping and almost chiseling to be done of the compact snow up in Fairbanks in the spring. But yeah, we just maintain the land generally.
Right. And that's a very attractive model, you know, for a lot of investors is to just have lot rent. I mean, but like you said, you still have tenants. I want to circle back to the comment you made earlier, which is that you've made every mistake in the book.
Yeah.
Can you give us maybe your top three or five mistakes?
We don't have time for that many. So that first park was on all private utilities, still is. It was on, among other things, a sewage lagoon, which are quite common, surprisingly common in Oklahoma. They're basically illegal where I live out in California. But, you know, there would be tens of thousands, maybe more of these in Oklahoma. So quite common. As part of my diligence, I got from the local Department of the Department of Environmental Quality there in Oklahoma, I got in writing a document stating they had inspected the lagoon and it was built to code. And lo and behold, a couple of years later, they had some turnover. Some new, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed inspector came along and said, oh, no, it's not made to code and you've got to do these kinds of repairs or we're going to shut you down and kick out all of the tenants. They really just don't care about families. They don't care about anything. They just care about their rules. And they just said, yeah, that's on our letterhead. That guy that wrote that letter is no longer with us. And even if he was, the lagoons just aren't built to code. And indeed, they were not. So this was just staggering incompetence on the part of government that somebody whose job it is to inspect sewage lagoons inspected it, passed it, and then somebody subsequent to him said, sorry, not built to code. So that was about a $500,000 mistake to make that right for the tenants. Or I could have kicked out the tenants and just shut down the park and displaced a couple hundred people. But that's not the kind of person that I am. So I cash flowed out of the park. I borrowed a bit more from my bank and I came up with $510,000 to fix the lagoon and build it up to code. So anyway, that's a mistake I made. I tend not to buy properties on private utilities now. And if I do, I'm actually more comfortable with the water, the wells being on private utilities. It's easier to just drill a well deeper for $5,000 or $10,000 than it is. It's easier to fix the front end of your water system than your back. But I learned that the paper that government puts things on is, you know, whatever they say is not worth the paper it's written on. So it's really hard to do diligence and really get to the bottom of that sort of infrastructure issue. You think you've done your diligence and then, you know, a quote-unquote professional from the government puts it in writing and it just doesn't hold water. So there's a big mistake I've made. That was with my own capital, not with outside investor capital. So
yeah, but I mean, is that really a mistake or is that just, you know, bad luck and like, well, this is what you get when you're dealing with the government? I mean, I don't know. Is there necessarily is there a lesson to learn there, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, so we tend to buy properties almost exclusively on all city utilities. So that means, again, we're hooked up to city water, city sewer. We would only maintain just the pipes on our property and sometimes not even the pipes. So that largely eliminates those sorts of whoopsies, as I call it, where you might have that sort of expense to make something right. So anyway, and certainly for anybody thinking of buying a park, at least their first park, I would advise that they not do what I did, call it a mistake, call it what you will. But I would say certainly for anybody new getting into the business, at least your first park, you want to be all city water, all city sewer, and not have that sort of risk that especially the back end of your water system goes bad or really even the front end. Just keep it simple, settle for a little lower return and just get your feet wet without having them held to the fire, as it were.
Right, right. Did that, when the lagoon was brought to code, did that change any experience for the tenants?
No. Oh. And, you know, so it is. I never got a thank you note from any of the tenants. They knew what was going on. But no tenant ever said like, hey, thank you. I know this is like going to make it harder for you to put your kids through college. But thank you for investing the money and keeping this place open. You know, no tenant ever wrote any sort of thank you note, not that I expected it.
but that's the way it goes.
Right. Right. Yeah. Wow. That's wild. That's wild. I would have been hard pressed. I mean, obviously 200 pads. So what did it take? 5 years to recover that? Or what was your payoff period for that?
Oh no, we had about 200 people in the community. It wasn't quite 200 pads, but yeah. So it's a little smaller community than that, but with families and kids, we basically kept 200 some odd people in their homes.
Right. So I guess the question was, how long did it take to recapture that expense?
You know, infinity. You know, it wasn't like I said, oh, hey, now the rent is going up $25
right,
simply because you've got a properly functioning toilet.
Right.
You know, there was no, this wasn't like putting in roads or a playground or a swimming pool or something for tenants. That this really had no impact. It was just making government happy. But this had no impact whatsoever on the tenants. So rents certainly didn't bump because of this. Rents have gone up some just because the economy there is strong and, you know, everything gets more expensive. That's what inflation is.
Right.
But I would basically say I'll never see any return on that capital. It was just a dead weight loss to make it right, placate the government, and keep a couple hundred people in their homes.
Right. Wow. Wow. Do you have any other hard-earned lessons?
Well, another one, maybe not quite as brutal, was just, you know, it took me too long to get into real estate. I bought that first park when I was, I believe, 39. Financially, I probably could have done it certainly 5 years sooner. It just took me too long to get into the business. As they say, the best time to buy real estate is yesterday. Second best right. time is today. So that first today came for me when I was 39 instead of, you know, 34. And then it also took me too long to scale up. It took me probably, I think it was roughly another 6 or 7 years before I raised outside capital and started with my first fund. I could have done that as well several years sooner, certainly if I had done a better job of hiring other better quality managers and even an asset manager to manage my properties for me. I've got what I call a Superman complex. I just think, and I probably can do most everything. I can do my own bookkeeping. I can answer my own phone. I can fly out there and oversee the guy who's redoing the floors and the walls and the carpet. You know, I can do all that, but I just have not done as good of a job as soon as I should have in outsourcing that stuff. Anyway, so instead of, you know, it took me 7 years to raise my first outside capital to then start buying and improving parks. Again, I probably could have done that every bit of 5 years sooner as well. So I'm probably 10 years behind where I should be, Sam, because I just took too long to pull the trigger, get into the business and scale up.
Yeah. And, you know, I think everybody probably thinks that at some point. But you've done it and you've gone places that a lot of people have not. So that's, yeah. That's, you know, kudos to you for that. What's a couple of things you've done right?
Well, first off, just getting into the business and then scaling up, as I call it. And I've covered this a bit on my podcast series. I've evolved from what I call Mobile Home Park 1.0 to Mobile Home Park 2.0. And whether your gig is mobile home parks or single family fix and flips or apartments or self-storage or whatever, the 2.0 is when you get to the point that you're really no longer managing the real estate. You're managing people that manage the real estate, both on site as well as off site, like marketing and accounting and some legal. So it's critically important to make yourself irrelevant. And, you know, I had come, as I mentioned earlier, I had come from the perspective of working for 20 years, basically all my 20s, all my 30s. I'd spent 20 years working for the man. And when you have a job, mentally, you want to make yourself indispensable. And I did that. And frankly, it helped me survive at that first high-tech, second high-tech, well, the first and the second high-tech companies were kind of right during the dot-com boom and bust. You know, and I survived layoffs because I was indispensable to the business. But that kind of mentality, when you're just taking on work for yourself, for anybody else, That doesn't work when you're an entrepreneur. You've got to make yourself irrelevant to your business and not indispensable. Right. You've got to hire in other people, give them clear direction, give them performance reviews, have systems to measure their contributions, hold them accountable. But ultimately, you've got to turn your business over to other people and make yourself irrelevant. So that was quite a mind shift for me from indispensable to irrelevant. And frankly, I have continued to fail to make myself completely irrelevant to my business, but I continue to hire on people and I strive for irrelevancy.
Right. Yeah. I've never heard it couched so poignantly. You're absolutely right. Like you in a job, you know, you want to be irreplaceable. But as an entrepreneur, we all know, I think, instinctively that we want to be irrelevant. Getting there is a different story. So I'm glad to hear you're still working on it, because I am definitely working on it. But you know, that's really awesome. That's a great point. Hey, we're running out of time here, Jefferson. Let's jump into the final four if we can. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Wish we had more time to keep talking, because I've got a million more questions for you. But we don't have time, so let's do the final four here. The final four questions are this. Number one is, what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Get in the game. Learn what you can, but don't use learning as an excuse for, you know, delaying getting in the game. At some point, you just got to pull the trigger, get in the game, and then the learning really begins. Right. So get in the game and strive for irrelevancy.
Absolutely. I love that. What is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
I am moving towards irrelevancy by implementing what is called EOS, the Entrepreneur's Operating System. I've actually hired a consultant to sort of, you know, beat it into me and beat it into my organization. We're not self-implementing. So we've got a consultant that is helping us now on a quarterly basis set goals, determine what we need to measure, who's going to do it, determine what people, if they're the right people, are in what seats and what their numbers are for their deliverables. So that's something that has been a help, is again having an outside consultant, so basically a business process consultant, just really ask a lot of good questions and push me towards irrelevancy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so I got started with the book by Gina Wickman called Traction. Mm-hmm. So I would advise folks to read that, get a flavor of it, and then if you can possibly afford it, don't try and do it yourself. Hire an EOS consultant to hold you accountable, meet with you, and push you into it and through it.
Right. No, that's great. That's great. Absolutely great. When it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
So we're obviously a for-profit private equity partnership, but we do have a social mission, which is to expand the supply of affordable housing. So a typical park for us might have 5, maybe 10 abandoned mobile homes that probably are salvageable. So we'll be putting $5,000 or $8,000 into each of those, fixing them up and offering them for tenants to buy, probably for under $800, often for under $700 a month. And they're going to own those homes typically in 2 to 5 years. And then a typical park might have every bit of another 10 or maybe 20 completely vacant pads. And we buy brand new houses at the factory. We create jobs at those factories. We bring those homes in and we make those brand new, nicer homes available for deserving families for under $1,000, often under $900 a month. So we help people become homeowners. We help them get out of the game of paying rent forever. Comparably sized 3-bedroom apartments in most of our markets would be $1,200 or $1,300. So we're again getting folks on a path towards home ownership for $700 to $900. So that's what we do to make the world a better place. We provide affordable housing that people are actually going to own.
Right. No, that's awesome. That's absolutely great. Jefferson, if listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Investors and other folks can probably come through our website. That's at parkavenuepartners.com. There's a link right at the top center of the page to join our mailing list. We're going to be launching our next fund here in May, just next month, May of 2021. So they can find out all about the fund and our track record, which is, again, generating double-digit returns for investors All that's right there. There's also a contact us button if folks have got specific questions, and we'll be doing webinars and dinners coast to coast and stuff like that. If folks are thinking of buying their own park, they can connect with our podcast and also our LinkedIn group, which has over 6,000 members. It's the biggest and best on LinkedIn. They can find all that just by going to mobilehomeparkinvestors.com.
Awesome. Jefferson, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.